Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, Miss John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 229th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 228 may be found under www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world. 10 stories daily. Try and subscribe. It's free. Today's show is a continuation of the three preceding shows celebrating National Poetry Month, which actually began last Sunday, April 1st. There was a celebration of poetry throughout the month, throughout the country, in my local northern Westchester and adjacent Connecticut area, as well as on this radio program. I have produced the calendar of the events and will send one to any who send me a request to at johnmack13@gmail.com. But I know that as part of National Poetry Month, I will be the featured poet tomorrow evening, April 9th, of Second Monday Poetry at the Stanford, Connecticut Barnes & Noble. I will be reading my poetry for about a half an hour, and there will be an open mic after it. Speaking of poetry, I started a terrific book, How to Read the Poet of 21st Century God to Writing Well, by Joe Bell and Jane Comaine, C-O-M-M-A-N-E, with many guest writers. And I'm going through it to get some ideas of what you might do if you're interested in poetry. Growing up in my neighborhood, Inwood, on the northern tip of Manhattan Island, poetry was not a big deal. Most of us weren't really interested in it. My guest next week will be a local poet from my area, Colin David. I was scheduled tonight to have another poet, Dorothy Friedman, but there was some follow-up with her as to the date of the show, and so she won't be on tonight. But I will be, number one, reading some poems, speaking with guests, and those wishing to join us on the air, they do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. As I mentioned, growing up in my neighborhood, poetry was not the big deal. In many cases, teachers in grammar school and in high school in those days, and possibly still today, tended to turn students off on poetry rather than bringing them in. When I started writing poetry, I just happened to wander into it, and then that's explained in a poem that I will be reading tomorrow night called Poetry. I was an English major in college, so I read a lot of poetry. I never really liked it. Sure, like some line, she walks in beauty, best not for whom the bell tolls, the minstrel boy to the war is gone, and many others. But we spent so much time trying to determine what Wordsworth, Keats, Browning, Chaucer, and Tennyson were trying to say, or why they showed such and such demeanor, that poetry became just another academic task to muddle through. I recognized that some, like my classmate Mark McCluskey, who later became a poet, really enjoyed poetry. But I preferred reading Norman Mailer, James Jones, Agatha Christie, and Leon Uris for my pleasure. And so I became a computer professional. And when I turned to writing, it became nonfiction, usually on technology. It might have stayed that way, but 45 years after closing the book of my English literature degree, something made me browse through the book of Charles Bukowski's work. Wow, this guy is nuts and great. So I bought 24 of his books and read them all, then began to write. Along the way, some folks encouraged me. I've sold some books and won a prize, so I've kept it up. But I also found some poets that I really like, M. Sexton, Billy Collins, Sharon Olds, Ben Jewell. Then I was happy to read that Jewell had been influenced by Bukowski. So blame Bukowski. As I mentioned, I wrote a poem, and I happened to put it into a contest, but I hadn't planned to. The woman from my old neighborhood, who was an English teacher, Jackie Wolf Birch, read the poem and she liked it, and she told me that I should do something with it, but I didn't do anything with it. And then about 4 months later, I happened to show it to the writer from Iona College, a friend of mine, George Hopkins. And he said, gee, do you want to enter it in this contest? And I didn't quite understand why I should, but I did. And about 6 months later, he sent me an email congratulating me on finishing third or fourth in this national contest. Now, third or fourth prize was $25, a year subscription to Poets and Writers magazine, and posting on a reward site. So it wasn't the big deal, but it hooked me. The first poem that I wrote, the one I just mentioned, was called Cashing a Check. I just saw this wonderful line in a column in the Motorcycle magazine. The mind writes checks that the body can't cash. The vision that many from my old neighborhood have of me is short and thin, with a Pepsi in one hand and a cigarette in the other. Others may remember me as taller than thin, hitting the jumper from the corner or throwing the no-look pass to a cutter. Others will picture me at the end of the bar in the Broadstone with an open pack of Pall Mells and a half-finished beer on the bar. John Gibson, I Can't Stop Loving You on the jukebox. Pat, one more and you have a chance. Age has taken the jumper. Diabetes has taken the Pepsi. Common sense has taken the cigarette and booze. I am older and wiser and hopefully more tolerant. I am satisfied with my life. But to just be able once more to fake the man guarding me and go up with a jumper and get nothing but net, to be able once more to cash that check. And that was the poem that started. And I mentioned both my old neighborhood and the Broadstone, and I'm on the phone, not expecting to be a major part of the conversation tonight, though, is the fellow who spent a lot of time with me, both in my old neighborhood and at the end of the bar in the Broadstone. Good evening, Mr. Donahue.
Good evening, John. How are you this evening?
I am well. And and as you probably heard, I'm not going through what I normally do with a guest, because I don't have a guest here. Now, one of the things for the audience that I was speaking to Chick today early on the phone really brings us to mind the fragility of our life. And I'm making plans for the next month, 2 months, to get some the radio show. Well, on March 10th, a friend of mine and of Chick's has an annual party or a benefit in memory of his son, who died at the age of 25 with a brain tumor. And he and his wife lay out this spread in this very nice restaurant in Bronxville. And they have the basket there for a scholarship fund in his son's name at the grammar school that he went to, the Lady Queen of Martyrs, that my friend went to, not the son. The principal comes, and students from the grammar school come. And every year between the fundraiser there and the checks that people who aren't able to attend send in, they raise about $20,000. And according to the principal, that puts 5 children through, and so far they've put through over 25 children through the program. And the and our friend, who's the MC and thanks everyone and tells jokes and everything, was terrific that day. And that evening, he had a stroke. And he was only in the hospital for a very short time. And then he was in the well-known rehab center for 2 weeks. And on Tuesday, he'll go into a nursing home. As of the present, he lost the use of his left leg. He did not lose any memory or cognition or speech. So he's way ahead of the then, but he's the kind of person that's always out. He's always going places, always meeting people. And then he obviously won't be as he's confined. So it was just the kind of thing that anyone with him in the afternoon that day never would have expected. But things like this seem to hit us all the time. Chick, you talked to him this week. What did you get from your conversation?
Well, I didn't get any medical information. I just wanted to let him know that, his friends, I heard from you that he had this stroke, and I was just calling to wish him well and to encourage him to get well and come on back out and let's go have a cup of coffee somewhere.
Okay. Well, we'll be seeing when he gets transferred into St. Patrick's. I saw that I had another caller on the line, but the caller disappeared. Possibly it was my original guest who was able to get a connection. One more poem before I go on, which is about where I am now, the reality. Reading Billy Collins or Bukowski or Sharon Olds is like watching Ted Williams hit or Steve Jobs sell the concept or Larry Bird see the court or Stephen Hawking think. I've aspired to all these skills and try my best, but did you ever read any poetry, Jake?
Well, actually, my brother Robert Emmett's a poet, and he's written some poems, and I really never had a great interest in poems. I spent some time with a guy by the name of Seamus Haney up in Cambridge, and very interesting man, and so I've been around poets. I've lived with my brother Bob and spent time, years, with Seamus and and as a matter of fact, this first week in June of 2018, my brother and I are going back to Ireland, going back to where our grandmother was born and raised before she immigrated to America. And the two of us are just going to, we're both in our 70s, and we're both just going to hang out and walk the roads of West Cork and try to smell all the stories and feel all the stories that we heard growing up. And as you know, John, a very Irish community like Inwood.
Yes, your brother Bob had a short story posted in a and he sent me a note about where it was posted, and it was a publication called Down in the Dirt. And I'd never heard of it, but it got me very interested in it. So since then, I've had some poems accepted by them, and they also have another magazine, and I have a short story that I wrote about a fictionalized encounter of Bat Masterson, who was not only the Western Marshal that people know of, but he was also a newspaper man in New York. He was the columnist at the end of his career, and I introduced a combination between him and my grandfather, who was a New York City police officer, as was my father, and they would have been about the same time period. So I have them in a short story. And one of the other characters, coincidentally, is the film named Sam Ash, who when I heard of him as a young person, was the boxing writer and the sportscaster on WNEW. Well, Bill McLaughlin, who you remember, well, the late Bill McLaughlin, and I went down when I was probably in early high school looking for autographs. And we went into, it was either WINS or WNEW, and Sam Ash had us in the studio with him and with others on his radio broadcast. Marty Glickman was one. I only found out years later that Sam Ash was Bat Masterson's office boy at the newspaper. So there's all these coincidences, and you and I know many of them. Like you mentioned, Seamus Heaney. Well, I believe that Peter Walsh knows him, and you know Peter Walsh from Coogan's, which is staying open. Yeah. So all of these things are interesting. I'm doing this reading tomorrow night, and one of the poems that I'm going to read is, it's called Poetry Readings. I read poetry a lot now, here and other places. At the conclusion of each poem, people smile and laugh, even clap. When I finish all the poems I read, they do it again. That makes me feel pretty good. Pretty good. I'd feel really good if they bought the goddamn books. Do you like that, Chick?
Yeah. Yeah, I have a few books I could sell them too.
Yes. They were just joined, that look like, by my guest, but she went away again, so I don't know. So what you're going to do. So you're coming up this week to be on the television show for the second time around on Comcast. Did you enjoy the beginning?
Yeah.
Episode
yeah, was,
one of you?
Say that again?
Did you enjoy
the first start? Go ahead.
Yeah. He's a good interviewer, isn't he?
He is. He made me feel very comfortable. I felt like I was sitting in his kitchen having a cup of tea and a cup of coffee and chatting away about some old friends of ours or something. Yeah.
For the audience, Chick has a book out that's been doing very well. It describes his delivery of beer to some friends from the same old neighborhood in Vietnam during the Vietnam War and getting caught in the Tet Offensive after he'd hitchhiked all around through the war zone. And it actually found four of the people that he had been there to deliver the beer to. Why don't you give the audience a brief overview of it?
Well, it started in 1967 late, and I had been at sea when young Tommy Minogue was buried, one of the 26 that I know of who were killed in Vietnam from Inwood. And I was very close to his family, his brothers, his mother and father. And I felt very sad about it. And I was coming through Central Park one day, and there was a huge demonstration going on against the war. And it appeared to me that they were demonstrating against the Tommy Minogues and all of the young men like him who was over there at the time. And what could I do? So I continued up to Inwood, and I went to, guess it was Doc Fiddler's or Chambers, I forget which one. And George Lynch was tending bar, and I was telling George what I saw in the park. And anybody who knows Inwood in those days, George Lynch was a legend and still is a legend. He was, we affectionately called him and respectfully called him the Colonel, even though he only achieved the status of a PFC in the Army. But anyway, And George, I was a seaman at the time, and George wanted my seaman's papers because we all agreed that somebody should go over there and tell those guys from the neighborhood that we do not share the same feelings about their participation in Vietnam in the war as the crowds did in Central Park. So obviously George couldn't take my seaman's papers and get over there, but I promised I would get a ship and go over there and buy them all a beer. So, you know, George, the next day I came back, he had one of the guys, Tommy Collins' mother there, waiting, an Irish immigrant woman, and she gave me $100 to give to Tommy, to go see her Tommy and tell Tommy that she prays for him every day, blah, 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 like a mother would say. And I could have used the 100, but I couldn't take the 100 because I knew if Tommy was either on one side of a river and I was on the other and it was full of crocodiles, or he was on the other side of a minefield, I would have to cross either one of them to get to Tommy if I took the 100. So it wasn't worth it. But as it turned out, Tommy was the first guy I found when I got to Vietnam. So I saw him and Ricky Dugan and Kevin McClune and Bobby Pappas. From Quinon up in Anquay in the Highlands and up by the DMZ by Quang Tri and then down to Long Binh outside of Saigon. And I told him what I was doing there. And, of course, it was a great laugh. And a great. I thought I'd get stopped somewhere along the way. You know, like, what are you doing? You're not supposed to be here. Get out of here. You know, they'd send me away. But actually, when that time came, there was no place to send me. My ship had gone, and I was then on what they call the beach, the expression. So I spent a couple of months there, and in the process, the morning I was supposed to leave, I reported to the U.S. Embassy to find it under siege. It was the first day of the Tet Offensive in 68. So that kept me there many, 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 many more weeks. And it was just a survival. But in the meantime, you know, I got a good front row view of the war. And I got to see some of the boys. And the irony of it is that after they came back, like most veterans, they don't talk so much about their war experiences. So they didn't hang around the bars in Inwood, which was a very popular thing at that time and our age, to tell the stories about Chickie coming over there. And when I would tell a story, nobody would believe me. So I stopped telling the stories. And then 40-something years later, I think it was 46 or 47 years later, somebody convinced us to do a reunion. So we did it up in P&K's because neither Doc Fiddler's or Chambers was is still in existence. So we did it up in P&K's, and we had a reunion, and everybody showed up but Kevin McClune. He was ill at the time. He's fine now. It got, I don't know, 350,000 hits or something like that on a YouTube, and Pabst Blue Ribbon promoted it around, and we've had a lot of laugh. And since then, we're all back hooked up together talking. I had lunch a couple of weeks ago with Ricky up there, and Tommy Collins last weekend out in Fort Myers. I live in Pompano Beach, Florida. And this past weekend, I saw Kevin McClune up in Jupiter. He has a winter home in Jupiter. And I expect to see Bobby Pappas next month sometime. We don't have the exact date. But anyway, it's like after a 50-year hiatus, we're back together. It was
how did it turn into book, Chick?
Well, you know, somebody once wanted to write a story about it, and they did, and a couple of people did. Breslin wrote a story about it. Dennis Duggan wrote a story about it at Newsday. A couple of people wrote stories about it in columns primarily. And one of the guys who wanted to write the story, Mike McAlary, who was a friend of Steve McFadden's from Inwood. Steve got in touch with me. McAlory wanted to meet. He wanted to write this story. So we met, and he wanted to write the story. Steve knew all about the story, told him most of it. But I told him it had been written and by Breslin and Duggan and other people. So I had him. I did. He did a story instead on my experiences in apartheid South Africa. And then when he got ill years later, and he was dying, one of his coworkers, my co-author, Joanna Malloy, who did a column for the Daily News for 25 years, she asked him, was there any story that he missed writing about? And he told her my story. So she went back to Steve McFadden. Steve called me. She came to me, and she wanted to write a book about it. So I said, at this stage of my life, I was in my 70s then. I still am. I said, yeah, why not? Sure, I'll cooperate. I said, I don't know if you get them other guys to cooperate, but she was a good reporter. She spoke to them all. She got their cooperation, and their stories are in the book. It's become a great fitting for me end of a career. And it's been an experience. And a lot of help from you, John, as you know.
The book is up on Amazon, and I can't recommend it enough. The interesting thing is the chick, as you might tell, is a storyteller. He was never a writer in the old days, but Joanna, who wrote much of it, who transcribed much of what he said, captured his voice terrifically. And since then, he's been telling the story on television shows and on radio shows, and he's been speaking to veteran groups and to union groups based on his background, and he really has developed the following for the book. Now, he mentioned Joanna, and of course, Joanna is a woman, and other of my poems is called "The Listening to Writers." Seven recently published writers, six poets and one fiction writer, all read last night at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center. There was much enthusiasm in the room as they read, that was well deserved. They're all very good. All seven were women. I looked around the room and noted that the women to men ratio was about 10-1. Perhaps I've the wrong organs for this racket. We are, I mentioned earlier, sitting in the Broadstone, listening to John Gibson singing "I Can't Stop Loving You." Let's listen to a little of that now.
Sometimes I can't stop wanting you. It's useless to say, so I'll just live my life in dreams of yesterday.
I mentioned the Broadstone and both just now and in the poem. And Chick and I and a number of other people from the neighborhood used to hang around in this bar, the terrific bartender, Pat Gallagher. And Chick was in the Marine Corps. And when he was going to Vietnam, I'm sorry, he didn't go to Vietnam. When he was going to Okinawa, he hung his dog tag on this big chain in the Broadstone. And he said he'd be back in 18 months to pick it up, and away he went. During the 18 months, to be there, and someone would say, "What's that hanging there?" and would explain it was Chickie's dog tag, and he was going to come back to pick it up, and everyone would laugh and have another beer. And then, sure enough, he did. And we all went down to the Broadstone, and Pat bought beers for everyone, and to give Chickie the dog tag, and we sang and everything was terrific. And then I left to go home. A little after I left, Chick got into the fight by the pinball machine and got barred from the joint, not forever, but for a while. How did that happen, Chick?
Well, you know, I have a selective memory sometimes, John, and those are the nights that I like to forget, the end of them. You know,
okay.
Had too many beers and stood up instead of sat down. So that happened.
Okay. I was too young for career and I was too old really for Vietnam. So I got to write about. I wrote the poem about my experience in the as the 6 months wonder, and I read it at the veterans a gala, and it went over fairly well. So I'll read it here. 6 months wonder. I was too young for Korea, although I had the friend whose older brother died there. I was too old for Vietnam, although I had friends whose younger brothers died there. I was working for a civilian. As a civilian for the Department of the Army, and there was pressure to get my military obligation out of the way. So I spent from November 1962 through May 1963 in Fort Dix, New Jersey, and Fort Sill, Oklahoma, as the 6 months wonder. I hated it. It was boring, repetitious, and an awful lot of chicken shit. I wanted to get out with my life. It was only later that I got to realize how much I learned in those few months. The Irish Catholic from New York City worked with the Protestant from Alabama who thought that the Pope was a heretic. The college English major found common ground with high school dropouts who thought reading was a big waste of time. The local basketball gym rat and fanatic found the same teamwork as part of an artillery career. The kid from the lily white neighborhood of Inwood saw his black platoon buddies suffer bigotry and exclusion in Lawton, Oklahoma. The tedium of spit shining shoes and cleaning a rifle with a toothbrush made me do things right. It was only much later that I found the answer to my constant question, "What is this good training for?" The answer was for life. What did you get out of the Marine Corps, Chick, do you think, the most important things?
Well, I really don't know. It's hard to answer, John. You know, I see a lot of veterans now, and the common thing is that, you know, you have a duty, a responsibility. That's no iffy, maybe, whimsy. It's either this or that, and I guess it's responsibility. You're responsible to do things at certain times and under certain conditions and blah, 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 blah. not to be second guessing it and all of that, and then just do your duty to the best of your ability. That's all. I often use that term to people a little bit different, and using it like this: do your job to the best of your ability, and everything else will work out. And I think I learned that in the Marines. Just do your duty to the best of your ability, and it will all work out.
I've told the audience a number of times about the neighborhood, and one of the poems that I wrote was My Inwood. I was born and raised in the Inwood section at the very top of Manhattan Island. It was an Irish Catholic Jewish section then. Each group thought the neighborhood belonged to them, and they were both right. It had three claims to fame then: a giant park with the large real forest, Columbia University's football stadium, and more bars than any neighborhood in New York City. People came from all over to watch football, play in the park, and drink in the bars. Walter Winchell called Ginwood in the press and on the radio. The legal drinking age in New York was 18 then, so we could start in the park at 15 or 16. When I first tasted beer, I didn't like it. That soon changed. We moved to the bars at 17 or 18, whether in the park or in the bars. The beer was merely the catalyst. It was the conversation that bonded us. I no longer imbibe. In the words of the great sports writer Jimmy Cannon, I stopped drinking 25 years ago. I retired with the title. I know a number who fell into the bottle. Most, however, did not. We became engineers, lawyers, accountants, writers, and technologists. Were it not for the half-quart cans of Pabst and the advent of the desktop computer, I never would have become the writer. So I owe a lot to the neighborhood and to the culture. I go back once a month for a luncheon. There are now very few bars. The neighborhood is Dominican at one end and gentrified and expensive at the other. The times and stores may be different, but the friendships and memories live on. Inwood is now the state of the mind. Who's got the church key? For those who aren't familiar, a church key was the slang for a can opener, and we opened, and that was in the days before pop tops. So we always needed the church key when 15 of us were sitting around with a couple of cases of beer. Do you agree that there wasn't the alcohol as much as it was the companionship and the stories and everything that got us going, Chick?
Absolutely, absolutely. It was the stories, each one to be topped. And, you know, there's one thing we all accepted. This has been in my youth, and in those bars and in the pubs, as they later became, but they were bars when we first went in them, was we knew people who were very smart, very talented in so many ways, and yet they were still there, particularly bartenders. We met so many bartenders. Everybody who was born and raised in Inwood, I think, is automatically qualified to be a bartender. And the stories they could tell, and we had one George could tell stories, and the mixture of New York City at the time was Irish and Jewish and Puerto Rican and African American, and he could go from one accent to another instantly. Pop, pop, pop. It'd be four different nationalities and groups discussing something, and he'd be telling the story in their dialect or in their accents, and he was just brilliant. But there was a lot of stories like George Lynch there.
We were in Dollarama when George was bartending, and George's have this routine where he was a Russian submarine commander, and he'd be talking all these terms and these noise, and he'd be sounding. And Jim Connors was with me, who took Russian in college, and he said, you know, he's not using any Russian words, but his accent is perfect.
That was good.
I mentioned some of the things that the chick's done, and he also mentioned that I had something to do with his the success of his present book, and he was nice enough to include me in the dedications. Well, I'm in the process of getting the book out the door. Hopefully, it'll be out in 2 weeks. And one of the dedications, and there are many, because I felt that I had to go all the way back to my inward years and bring it up to now. But one of them is to my regular radio caller, who has constantly reinvented himself, always to the better, in the 65 plus years that I've known him, John Chick Donahue. And Chick's whole life has been the reinventing of himself, from a high school dropout to the master's from Harvard to to the person with the bestseller, to finding out that one of the reasons he didn't do well all the way up to Harvard was he was dyslexic. He didn't find that out until he was in the 70s. Give the audience an overview of your life from drinking halfway up the path with me to today, Chick.
Oh, wow, John. First of all, it's a long time. I grew up in a great neighborhood, and some people ask me, what kind of neighborhood was it? And I tell them, well, we had a big castle in the neighborhood when I was a kid. And they say, had a castle? And you grew up in New York? Yeah, I said, we had a castle. It was in part of the woods. You had woods too. You lived in Manhattan. Yeah. So that was my start in telling stories. Of course, the castle I'm talking about was the Cloisters, and in the woods was Inwood Hill Park or Fort Tryon Park. If it wasn't for Dyckman Street, they would have been one and the same. So that's where I started, and I always told stories, and I had a lot of fun, and it. I don't know. You know, I like to tell a George Lynch story. George Lynch thought he was a colonel, I think, in the end of his life, because we called him colonel for years. And at one time, I owned Doc Fiddler's after the war. I purchased Doc Fiddler's from the previous owners, Tommy Coughlin and Richie Schinnick. And George was my day bartender. And George didn't drive a car, but every Friday, he would take a cab down to the George Washington Bridge bus terminal and get on a bus and go up to West Point. And he would check into the Thayer Hotel in West Point and then go spend the day, the weekend, at the Officers Club. And for some reason, they thought he was a colonel too, because there were a number of times when something was missing in a delivery or something that's now in the weekend, and my partner and I, Jerry O'Sullivan, who I've known since the fourth grade, what did George should have done this? And where is he? So I said, he's up in the Officers Club in West Point. And he says, get out of here. He's in the Officers Club. Here's the number. Call. So I call the Officers Club, and the guy announced the Officers Club. And I'd ask for Colonel Lynch. And he's, yes, sir, he's here. And he would put Colonel Lynch on the phone. Everybody thought Colonel Lynch was Colonel Lynch, and I loved the idea. If you asked him, he'd say, well, in my military career, I attained the rank of PFC, but he ran the car wash or the Jeep wash in Germany, someplace in Germany where he was stationed. I'm still amazed at George Lynch in our neighborhood. But, you know, I was one of six kids. We all went to Good Shepherd. We all... whatever, a different era, a total different era.
But you also came from both Union family and a political family, so that was a start for you.
Yes. Right? Absolutely. My grandfather was very much involved in the Democratic Club in Washington Heights. This was before they had a Democratic Club in Inwood, and in 1948. the Heights and Inwood were probably 50-50 of two major groups in the Democratic Party. One was the Irish, and the other were Jewish. And Jake Javits ran against Paul O'Dwyer for Congress and split the vote. And my family, in the name of my aunt, Aunt Florence, she was so upset that she felt like the Irish community was abandoned. And so she quit the Democratic Club that was then up on 181st Street in Washington Heights and opened up a Dyckman Democratic Club that actually opened up on 207th and Broadway. And we started our own club. It was like the McManuses down on the West Side. It was like a family club. And I grew up in that clubhouse. That was part of my education in that clubhouse. And my father on the other side of where I come from and who I am was came from a very big Irish working class family. And their father died young. And my father had to go to work at the age of 14 to help support the family. So he was he didn't have much of an education at all. He certainly didn't have a high school diploma. And he was a working man, and he sold his labor, and that's how he fed his family. He had six children, and a very proud man. But he knew, and he instilled in me that people like him, working people that didn't have any other benefits other than their labor, needed a union. And my father was very, very, very pro-union. So I got the Democratic Party from my mother. And I got the labor movement for my father. And that blended into what I became. I became a political director for my union I was the political director for more than three decades. But I got to work in the union. It was the St. Ogg's Union. The city went broke in 73, 74. They had no political person or political committee or anything. So my Democratic Party experience, we formed a political committee. We raised money as men went back to work. They would contribute a couple of pennies an hour. They were well paid then, but still underpaid. And I became the political director, and they sent me to Washington. They sent me to Albany. I worked in City Hall. And I had a fantastic life all the time. I never worked for politicians. I only worked for my union. That's all I did. And I enjoyed it. I was proud, like my father, of the union, proud that I was an officer of the union, and used the political abilities that I heard just listening on Saturday mornings when the political operators played cards in the Democratic Club on Broadway. At the age of, oh God, how old was I? 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So that carried me through. And I became the union guy on many campaigns. On some campaigns where the candidate didn't stand a chance of winning, but for my particular union, the St. Ogg's Union, tunnels were important to us. And if he was going to support tunnels, we were going to support him. It was as simple as that. Mike Bloomberg will tell you I was the first union to endorse him. Mike Bloomberg signed my book saying one of my oldest friends and first supporters. And then he actually put in there, I owe you, Chicky. And I called him back and said, where were you when I needed, when I was trying to raise a family? I got an IOU from the eighth richest man in the world. It isn't doing me any good. But it put me in situations like that. Pat Moynihan got me into Harvard. He helped me get into Harvard. Geraldine Ferrara helped me get in there. Jimmy Breslin helped me along the way. I got a lot of help from a lot of people in New York in particular, who like seeing a working man get ahead and like seeing helping other workers. So I'm very happy with what I've achieved.
Didn't you have a falling out? Didn't you have a falling out with Breslin for a while. Did you ever put that back together again with him?
Well, I had a falling out where he wrote a book, Table Money, and it was a bestseller, and it was famous book, I guess, whatever. Everybody was happy with it, and I spent 6 months with him, and I was with him almost every day for those 6 months while he was writing that book, and he never thanked the union. He never thanked any of the officials of the union. He never thanked any of the members of the union, and I was offended, not for myself so much, but the book was about the union. The book was about those people and never recognized any one of them. So I took him to task for that. And unfortunately for him, he was hanging around in the same political type of fundraisers and rooms that I was. So every time I saw him, I did what you would have done in a neighborhood like Inwood. I busted his shoes. And his wife used to help me. And I said, I loved her. Hey, Breslin, have you learned how to say thank you yet? And under that, we were still friends, but we had this thing going back. He was a dick, what I don't want to say now, but he was sick and he wouldn't admit it, but I wouldn't let him forget it. But, you know, on the other hand, I had a young Sanhog who went on to Harvard also, graduated Fordham, wrote a number of books, Thomas Patrick Kelly. And he worked, he became very tight with Breslin. And Breslin helped him along too, but, and remained so. He was like my third son, Tommy Kelly. He still is. He was a great writer. He does, he's into media and he's a showrunner and all of that stuff now. He's deep into movies and shows and everything.
But I guess on the radio show. And his book, Empire Rising, is the best book that I've ever read about the times about the building of the Empire State Building. He also wrote the book set in Inwood called Rackets that you're the character in. So that's another hook. How did you tell the audience
John, he wrote three books. You named two of them. The first book he wrote was Payback. And that had to do with my running thing with Breslin. And that was about the Sanhogs and the water tunnel.
Right. Tell the audience how that you, as a high school dropout with a GED and without the college degree, wound up with a master's from Harvard.
Well, I worked campaigns. When the AFL-CIO would endorse somebody for governor or mayor or senator in the state and then on to national campaigns, they would insert me often into the campaign to make sure that the union support for that candidate was not being misused for other candidates that the unions might not have been supporting, and for those unions to get proper credit for what they did on those campaigns. As a result of that, I represented the labor movement on a lot of campaigns in the period of about 25 years. A lot of these people won. And they became mayors, governors, senators, congressmen, and they knew me and my name and my face as the contact to the labor movement. So when they would have questions on a union issue, they would contact me, and I'd advise them about it. I remember one time coming from Inwood, and I was advising Ed Koch when he was in City Hall. And I was down there one day, and I was waiting to go in to talk to him about some labor issue. And Charles Hurry, who was then the Taoiseach, the Prime Minister of Ireland, came to visit. And he had an entourage of about a dozen people with him, and they were all going into the mayor's office. And the guy in charge of ushering people into the office saw me in the waiting room, assumed I was part of his gang, because I was chatting away with them, what county were they from and all of this, and ushered me when I tried to explain, no, I'm not with them. No, come on, all of you. So he pushed me in the room. So the mayor's saying hello to each one of them, shaking everybody's hand, and he gets to me and he says, "What the heck are you doing here?" I said, "I don't know, he thought I was part of his party, so he pushed me in here with him." So it's because I had these relationships with these guys, David Dinkins, Bloomberg, both of the Cuomos and the Tommy, what was whatever, I forget his name, from who was the governor for years, isn't this sick, from Peekskill. Anyway, it's because I knew all these people. And when they'd come into a crowd, they knew what they were going to get with me. I wasn't going to butt their chops about that. Anyway, so a number of them told me, you should go to this Kennedy school, that they need guys like you up in this Kennedy school. And the guy who really gave me the nerve to try it was a guy by the name of Harry Van Osdale from Local 3 and the president of the Central Labor Council. And he urged me to apply. And a bunch of guys helped me. So I applied. And I had to do some writing, which was difficult. So I did what I had to do. And I had like a committee advise me on this and that, like I would go about any campaign type of effort. And then when they wanted to accept me, but I didn't have any academic credentials for them to justify it. And they called me and asked me to withdraw my application. Well, when Harvard calls and asks me to withdraw an application, I knew that they didn't want to reject me for some reason, whatever that reason was. One of them politicians must have asked to accept me or something, though I didn't ask any politicians for help at that time. So I said I couldn't. The year was 87. And I have a national campaign I got to do next year, 88. We didn't know who the candidate was going to be, blah, 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 blah. So as soon as I got off the phone with them, refusing to withdraw my application, I called Moynihan. And I got hold of Moynihan. And I knew the chairman of the admissions committee for Harvard was John Dunlap, a former Secretary of Labor and a friend of Moynihan, and I asked Senator Moynihan, could he call this guy and tell him that, they should accept me? And I promised Moynihan that if I didn't pass, I'd take their summer program first. And if I didn't pass muster in the summer program, I wouldn't go into the regular fall semester. So he called. I don't know if he passed that on to him. I did pass the summer program, and I went into the regular and I graduated a year later with a master's in public administration. But more important, at the time, the clerical workers up there were trying to organize a union. They were in their seventh year in 1987. And Tom Kelly, who I had sent up there like as an advance man the year before in 87, we both got elected student government. And we got the student government to help the workers organize the union there, and they won, and we just had so much fun. And that's how I got to know Haney. He was the resident poet up at Harvard, and one of the organizations we formed was the Gaelic Association of Harvard, the Kennedy School at Harvard. And we found Haney, and he agreed to come over to us and hang out with us, and we became great partners. It was a great experience, and it was sort of like go back to that. Say, what did I learn in the Marine Corps? Just keep going. Just do the job to the best of your ability, and it'll take care of itself. And that's been my life, John.
That brings us to another question, really. It was only well after your Harvard experience that you found that much of your difficulty with education previously was because you were dyslexic and you were undiagnosed until you more or less self-diagnosed it yourself, and one of your grandchildren was diagnosed. How were you able to cope with the work at Harvard without either the educational background and with the learning disability? How did you push yourself through there?
Well, my initial education was before the Marine Corps. It was Good Shepherd School. It was Rice High School and then George Washington High School. And it was hard for me to do it. I did not like to read. I couldn't read. Though if you gave me a history book, for some reason, I could get through a history book. But anything else I couldn't read. It was a job. I didn't like it. And I paid no mind to it. I did not do my job to the best of my ability as a student. That's primarily, right? And then when I went off in the service, and then I come back later, and I had to do things. I had to, read, but not, if somebody would have said to me, I used to hear this expression, I can't wait to get to the beach and get a nice comfortable chair and pick up a nice good book and just relax. Well, reading a book was not relaxing for Chickie. It was like digging a ditch. I avoided it. But when I got to where I got to, and I realized the significance, I'm at Harvard. I'm Chickie Donahue, and here I am a student at Harvard Graduate School. As a matter of fact, as a kid, I remember hearing my mother, we'd ask her a difficult question to answer for her. And she would say, what do I look like? What do you think I have, a Harvard degree? I heard that since I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. So here I am. I couldn't fail, John. If I failed, I couldn't go home. And besides, at home, I had kids. I had a wife and kids and a mortgage and all the other things to contend with. So I just didn't have the option of failing as I did when I was younger. So that's how I got through it.
That's a great story. One of the songs that really changed our generation, I think, when we moved from the Frank Sinatra to other things, I'm coming up here for a moment. We'll listen to a part of this song.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around 10 o'clock tonight. Put me back.
That was the song that many of our parents hated, but it was the number one song on the number of lists because it was the theme song to Blackboard Jungle, and then after that it was also in another movie, Rock Around the Clock, that was an Alan Freed. So it was the number one song 3 times. So it made the big difference, and that kind of changed a whole generation, I think, music and everything, and also as we moved into the 60s, the integration, the civil rights movement, and you were there ahead of us, really, with your Democratic parties. So you were at the forefront of many of these things, and you told me that unlike many construction units. Unions that the Sandhogs were always integrated. Why was that, Chick?
Well, it's a long history. I actually did a book on it. I hired my cousin Paul Delaney. He's the author. If you look it up, I was the production editor. I had to make sure that I didn't write any bad things about some people. Anyway, the history is that a lot of freed slaves were in New York after the Civil War. A lot of Irish immigrants were in New York after the Civil War, and they were looking for cheap labor to work on this project that turned out to be the Brooklyn Bridge. Roebling was digging the foundation, and they actually began what was the biggest. There was only one other air job before that, but it was the foundation. They'd sink a box under the river, and they'd send men in there and dig it out, literally dig it out with shovels and take it out. And they were dying left and right. They did not understand the problems of compressed air on human beings. And they learned about it, but at the expense of killing these men who were working on it. Most of them were Irish immigrants and blacks. They formed a union. It wasn't over wages. It was purely that they were killing them, that the safety. And years later, I remember telling the Chamber of Commerce in New York that, I come from a union because I knew a lot of businessmen. I was involved in these campaigns. There were a lot of businessmen there. And they would say, oh, another union guy. No, you don't understand. I said, I come from a very proud union, over 100 years old at the time. I said, we've never had a strike over a dollar issue. We've had 3 strikes in our history. I made that up because nobody knows exactly, but we were not known to strike. In my 40-something years there, we had 1 shutdown. It lasted a couple of days, and that was over safety. We had lost 26 men buried, 24 men dead on 1 job, the third water tunnel. So the history of the union was safety, 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 which is all miners. But to get back to the blacks and the Irish. So they worked down there, and all during the Depression, particularly when they did the Queens Midtown Tunnel, and the other trades would want to go down there. They would say to themselves, those guys are doing all work down there. And the Irish supported their brothers, the blacks. The blacks supported their brothers, the Irish, which made it a very, very, very strong union. And for years, up until almost this century, the last 20 years, we were not members of the AFL-CIO building and construction trades as a result of that, because we did all of the work in the tunnels. The only other trade down there was operating engineers. And at the time, they were led by Irish immigrants. And that's what started it. And most of the Irish immigrants who worked there and formed what is the modern union today was in the 20s. And that came after the Irish Civil War. So a lot of militant Irish wound up in the Sandhogs Union. And it remained that way. When I first started, a lot of unions in New York were father-son union. That was to have a job for their sons. Most of them were forced to change those rules because they were proven to be discriminating against primarily blacks, but other minorities, women, whatever. But the Sandhogs clearly could not be accused of that because they made up 50% of the union, and still do.
Reason that probably started after the Civil War and everything was about that time, the Irish and the blacks, they were the throwaways. They were the people who if something happened to them, well, you had another one. There's a great book, When the Irish Became White, and they talk about how that the Irish, they were primary stevedores in Mobile, Alabama, because that during slavery, I'm talking about, if some of the black slaves went overboard, the landowner or the owner was out dollars. But if one of these Irish got washed overboard, so what? You know, you hire another one. You know, so it was when they came here, they had extremely tough, and down south they didn't have the value that even the slaves had because it was a financial investment in the slaves.
Well, they were terrific. They were the original expendables. They could lose them. We could get rid of them. That doesn't matter. There's another one waiting right behind them. And after slavery, the African Americans had the same problem. The exact
same
problem.
Right. Sure.
Just lose them. So
and
well.
That's what happened in the
history shows that the first tunnel under the Hudson River, that the contractor they were hiding the bodies. They were dying in those tunnels, taking the bodies out and hiding them. And they were poor to begin with. They would look like vagrants, bums or whatever. And they would just throw them down in the skid row or something as if they they died from alcoholism or something, and what it really was the bends that killed most of them. They just didn't care. Yeah.
Well,
that's the history of the Sandhogs.
That's the history of the Sandhogs. Thank you very much for filling in, Chick. And it's been a tremendous show tonight. It's National Poetry Month, and we did some poetry, but it was mainly your story, which is a fascinating story. And
and
the audience, if you haven't bought the book, you should. And Chick, I will see you on Wednesday morning.
So, great, Johnny.
As
good luck.
Thank you very much. And as Howie Rose says at the beginning, after Met Win, put it in the book. And hopefully there's a lot of Met Wins this year. And I hope you're with us next Sunday when poet Colin David of Peekskill will be my guest. And as I used to say to an old neighbor, see ya. Alexa, play Jerry Lee Lewis and Good Golly Miss Molly.
Good Golly Miss Molly, alternate one, by Jerry Lee Lewis.
Good Golly Miss Molly, she sure likes to fall.
Good night, everybody. Thank you very much, Chick, again.